You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Chronicle of Higher Education reported this year that one out of every five government student loans that entered repayment in 1995 has defaulted. The past summer, the national outstanding balance on U.S. student loans was $830 billion, exceeding total credit card debt in the country. Those figures, coupled with a grim job market, have led to inevitable comparisons with the housing crisis and warnings of another bubble that may soon burst. Joining us now are Malcolm Harris, author of an article called Bad Education for the literary magazine N Plus One, and Lauren Asher, founder of the Project on Student Debt, an initiative of the Institute for College Access and Success, where she is also president. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren, do you think the comparisons to the housing crisis are reasonable? Is there a bubble waiting to be burst?
In fact, while it's tempting to make the comparison, I don't think that it's that robust. And it depends on which piece you're looking at. Certainly, if you're looking at for-profit colleges where virtually all students borrow and a very, very high proportion default, and they represent half of all federal student loan defaults but enroll only about 10% of students, you also see very, very high percentages of borrowing of private student loans, which are much more like subprime mortgages than federal student loans. There's certainly reason for concern.
Well, from a lending perspective, you don't need a credit score, income, assets, or employment to get a federally backed student loan. Isn't that similar to the subprime lending that caused the housing crisis?
Well, federal student loans are a form of financial aid. They're not a commercial product. And they also come with very important repayment options and consumer protections that other kinds of debt don't provide. Now, people can't resell their education. They're investing in their own future earnings. And even if the price of higher education fell tomorrow, you wouldn't see a similar sudden loss in the value of the education people already had as you do with people who bought houses. There isn't a speculative market in the way that there has been in housing before the bubble burst, and who knows, could be again.
But the housing bubble burst because homeowners started defaulting and stopped buying. Isn't that a possibility for student loan holders?
Well, is it a possibility that there will be student loan defaults? Certainly, we've seen worrying increases in defaults on federal student loans, again, highly concentrated in this one sector where there's been a lot more parallels to the subprime loan industry and the housing market. Generally, a college education is still the best investment you can make in the future. The earnings premium on a degree is still very, very high as it's ever been. But there is reason to be concerned about folks who are borrowing a tremendous amount, and particularly who are borrowing non-federal loans where there are very few borrower protections. Overall, higher education, as I said, is still a very good investment, but depending on where you go to school and how much you pay, you can see very different results, and the returns aren't guaranteed. So we all should be shopping around to make sure we're not borrowing more than we need to, but some modest borrowing in federal loans can help people get through school in 4 years without dropping out or stopping out, without working excessive hours that make them unlikely to complete. That's still a pretty good investment.
Malcolm, in your article, you drew comparisons between the mortgage-backed securities of the housing crisis and its equivalent in the education sector, the student loan asset-backed security. What are they?
So student loan asset-backed securities are these financial products that we saw rise in the whole wave of asset-backed securities in the 90s and early 2000s. In the housing crisis, we saw the collapse of these housing-backed securities, which were when you take out a loan, then the bank has your loan. They combine a bunch of these loans together to get a geographically diverse group. It's called a tranche. And then they sell that on the secondary market, presumably getting rid of all the risk for individual sellers by mixing them all together. Mm. And we have the same thing more or less happening with student loans, where you have these student loan asset-backed securities, or as they're actually called, slabs.
And are they still on the market? Who's buying them?
Very much so. They've actually haven't seen the same decrease that every other kind of asset-backed security are. They haven't seen that drop.
What percentage of student loans makes up these securities?
It's about 30% of federal student loans are securitized right now.
Well, Lauren said she didn't see the possibility of a bubble. Are you suggesting that we should be concerned about that?
Well, there are a number of ways to think about the bubble. Fundamentally, when we're talking about a bubble, we're talking about we see something that isn't all the way there. We've got the shell of value, but nothing actually there inside. I think when we look at the loans students have taken out, we see the shell. We see that students were awarded, you know, six-figure loans, $200,000, based on their ability to repay that sometime in the future. If they don't have the ability to repay that sometime in the future, which they may not given the unemployment statistics for young graduates, then there's your bubble right there. Whether it will pop and cause damage to the economy in the same way the housing bubble did, I think is a very different question.
Lauren, since the late 1970s, the cost of tuition has gone up. I'm surprised by this figure. I'm not sure I'm even willing to say it. 900%?
Education, the cost, let me say, the sticker price of higher education has risen very quickly. And that's part of why we've seen a growth in student debt. On average for the last few years, we've seen the average debt of four-year college graduates grow about 6% a year.
Nonprofit right. And state universities?
When you combine them all together, you see nonprofit, for-profit, and public, the average debt for a four-year college grad was about $24,000 for the class of 2009. But you see very big differences across different types of schools. The best data for each sector, actually from the year before, from a big national survey, so a total of 67%, a little more than two-thirds of all four-year college grads had debt in 2008, likely a little more in 2009. 62% of graduates of public universities had loans, 72% from private nonprofits, and 96% from private for-profits, where you also see very different pricing. So the average debt at public universities was a bit over $20,000, at private nonprofits about $27,500, and at private for-profits about $33,000 or more. When you look at net price and sticker price, you also see some differences, which I'd be happy to speak to. But I want to come back for a moment to Malcolm's comment about the $200,000 in debt. We focus on undergraduate student debt, and the latest numbers indicate that just about 0.5% of all four-year college grads had $100,000 or more in debt. That's about 7,000 people. For those people, it's a tremendous burden, but it is not a crisis proportion at that level. Now, 24,000, which is the average, is nothing to sneeze at, and it means that people are going to weigh their decisions about buying a home, having a family, their ability to save for retirement and for their own kids' education, or to risk starting a business and taking on more debt differently. And that's why we do want to be concerned about and try and address the growth in student debt, both the need to borrow at the front end and the repayment options at the back end.
You want to respond, Malcolm?
Yeah, no, absolutely you're right that the really, really high debt, the six-figure debt, is a small percentage. But when we're talking about an average of 24,000, that's not just a question of, well, I may not be able to start a family as quickly as I might want to, or, you know, I won't be able to buy a car. We're talking about I need to find a job as soon as possible, whatever will pay whatever amount. And that's putting young people in. I mean, the crisis is already here for young people. This
isn't
delayed.
Does Washington education policy and budget decisions affect tuition increases? Will slashing budgets give license to more increases?
Well, state budgets are a big driver of cost for the majority of students. The majority of undergraduates go to public colleges, and there it's really about how much states are spending on subsidizing their higher education systems to limit what gets passed on in terms of tuition and fees, and how much they're providing in financial aid to cover whatever they're charging in tuition and fees for those who can least afford it. And we've definitely seen a real hit at the state level, certainly here in California, where the budget situation has been in crisis for some time, and in New York and other states.
In California, they only charge fees because, as I understand it, public institutions can't charge tuition by law. But
that's
it's the same
true,
thing, isn't it?
It's the same thing, yes. And the amounts are significant. I think it's worth noting that there's a big gap between sticker price and net price for college, and that when you look at sticker price, you should be looking not just at tuition and fees, but the full cost of attendance. You don't just need to pay what we sometimes call the access cost of tuition and fees, but also what are sometimes called the success costs of books, supplies, housing, food, other things that you need to be able to go to school and complete. Research shows that going part-time instead of full-time, going to community college instead of going to a four-year if you're qualified, dropping out or stopping out, and working more than 20 hours a week while you're in school all lead to significantly lower completion rates. And you only get the benefit of the investment in your education if you complete, and if you complete a degree or certificate that's recognized in the marketplace. So there's no question that there's real distress and worry out there about having to borrow, but some modest borrowing with federal loans can actually help people get to that point where they're going to get the value back from their degree. Most people do pay off their federal loans over time, but the worry about it is real. And Malcolm, I take your point. We started the project on student debt in 2005 out of exact concern for the kinds of impacts on individuals and our economy that rising student debt may have if not addressed. That's why we developed the framework for what's called income-based repayment. It's only been around for a couple of years, so we're not seeing the effects yet on default rates. It should make it a lot easier for people with federal loans to avoid default because it can cap your payments at a reasonable percentage of your actual earnings, adjusted year to year based on what you really earn and your family size. And if for some reason you can't pay it off in 25 years, which most people will be able to do, any remaining debt and interest is forgiven.
My guest, Lauren Asher, founder of the Project on Student Debt and president of the Institute for College Access and Success, and Malcolm Harris, who's written an article called Bad Education. It's in the current issue of N Plus One magazine. Malcolm, how are students assessed in terms of their ability to pay back their loans? The cohort default rate, which essentially puts out national figures on defaults, only looks at defaults in the first 2 years. Don't most people default way after those first 2 years?
Well, and that number is going to change to the first 3 years in the next year, I believe. And just extending it that extra year has inflated that number by, I believe, 14%. Mm-hmm. That's hopefully what the article says. And so, yeah, as we look longer out, we see the default rates increasing. We don't really have good data on defaults, and we certainly don't have good data about the current cohort, what our possible defaults are going to be, given the economy and given the increase in tuition.
Are schools penalized if they have a higher default rate?
Theoretically, they are. Theoretically, schools like we're talking about, private, for-profit universities, are about to get penalized in all sorts of ways. Because they don't set up their students to repay loans in any way, shape, or form.
So it would be in the best interest to not have the student default, at least in the first 2 years, now 3 years.
Absolutely.
But
but down the line, these are numbers where that the Department of Education isn't even really tracking.
So, Lauren, what happens after those two, soon to be 3 years?
Well, the consequences of default for borrowers are very severe. If you default on a federal student loan, the government can collect until you die, although not after, unlike private student loans where lenders can sometimes go after your estate and your cosigners indefinitely. With federal loans, the government can garnish your wages. It can even take a part of your Social Security payments if it goes that far. Your credit rating is trashed, which means it's hard to get housing, rental housing, credit cards, or a job. You can't get other federal student aid. And defaulted loans don't qualify for income-based repayment.
But isn't it in the best interest of the lenders for you not to default? Do they give you any leeway?
There's a lot of leeway with federal student loans. Default doesn't kick in until 9 months of non-payment. So unlike, again, private student loans where they can declare you in default for myriad reasons, including being even a day late on your loans, neither private nor federal loans are dischargeable in bankruptcy. They're treated more like unpaid criminal fines, even though private student loans, which have been non-dischargeable since 2005, are held a lot more like credit cards in every other way. They're not a form of financial aid. So the risks, if you default, the effects are severe, but the ability to avoid default is significantly higher with federal student loans than with really any other type of debt.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with Lauren Asher and Malcolm Harris. But first this. We're back with Lauren Asher, a nationally recognized expert on student loans and financial aid, president of the Institute for College Access and Success, which is home to the Project on Student Debt, which Ms. Asher co-founded in 2005, and Malcolm Harris, a writer and editor based in Brooklyn, and his work focuses on education and generational politics. He's written an article called Bad Education for the literary magazine N Plus One. He's also the managing editor of the criticism site The New Inquiry and a contributing editor to Shareable.net. And we have been receiving all sorts of comments from our listeners, and maybe we could address a few of them. Lauren, a listener, asks, why is school so expensive? Who ends up benefiting from these huge tuition rates?
Well, I think, again, it's important to look at the overall price. And absolutely, school costs have risen, and they are genuinely intimidating to all families and students who are thinking about a college education. I've got a nearly four-year-old kid at home, and this is something my husband and I talk about all the time.
And you got have to start preparing now when the child
absolutely.
Is four. Although you have no idea what tuition is going to cost by the time the child is 18.
I'm guessing it will be more. But I can tell you a little bit about net price because I think it's helpful to put in context. The sticker price tells you almost nothing about what you in particular are going to pay for college. And while there are a lot of people who will debate why the sticker price is rising at different types of schools, the answers are going to be quite different depending on who you talk to and the types of schools you look at. At public colleges, as I said, it's really about how much of the total cost of providing that education the state covers up front, and then how much is passed on to students and families and what aid is available to cover it. There is no doubt that college costs have risen faster than family incomes and faster than available grant aid for many years now. And that's why we've seen this worrisome growth in student debt, which at the individual level can create a lot of stress and distress over a long period of time. But if you look at average net price, which is what people are paying after grants and scholarships, so the amount that they have to either borrow, earn, or save to cover, you get a slightly different story. If you'll bear with me, at public four-year colleges, the most recent data for the class of 08, the sticker price, total cost of attendance, was $19,300. The average net price was about $15,500. At nonprofit 4 years, it was about $37,500 in sticker price, $26,500 in net price. And at for-profit four-year colleges, $33,500 in average sticker price and almost $31,000 in average net. I know that's a lot of numbers on the radio, but you see much more discounting at nonprofit 4 years, which are the ones we tend to see in the headlines, the Harvards and the Bards, et cetera, that often have more of their own money to put towards aid. And the least amount of discounting at for-profit 4 years, we've got by far the highest net price, almost $31,000.
So if they see that you need help, they can come through. That's of course, that's only if you're doing well.
Well, and depends on what kind of resources the college has and how the college chooses to spend those resources. Some schools have made what are called no loan or low loan pledges, and we track those on our Project on Student Debt site. No loan doesn't mean no cost, but in many cases, schools have come out and said, look, if you are low income to middle income, we won't put any loans in your financial aid package. We'll make up the difference in grants. You still have to contribute something, and what they expect you to contribute can vary. But of what they consider to be your financial need, more than you can afford to contribute, they'll make sure there are no loans in the package. And that can make a big difference.
This is sort of what's called the high aid, high tuition practice, where schools will raise tuition, as we've seen, as you said, 900% since the 70s, and then distribute some of that money in terms of aid and say, look, if you need money, we can provide it to you. But there's a big gap in the middle for middle-income students.
Well, of the student borrowing population, who's at the highest risk of over-borrowing?
Between the different kinds of schools? Mm. Well, for-profit private universities as Lauren said, are the worst across the board. But this really is a case where we can't just blame, the bad apples and say they're infecting a good barrel. There are people benefiting from and who have benefited and continue to benefit from high tuition, even at public universities.
JJ left this comment on our show page. He says, I have 90K in student loans and 60 is interest. I have owed for 15 years, and I must choose between student loan payment or health insurance. Health wins. It seems obvious that one step is to forgive the interest, which is immoral to charge anyway for something as mandatory as education.
Well, and this is going to be a larger and larger issue with the coming generation that's going to have way more student debt than our parents did, where you're going to have to look at some sort of larger forgiveness program, like forgiving draft dodgers from the Vietnam War, where people, a whole generation is going to be, you know, 5-6 figures in debt and not being able to pay it. That's a recipe for social instability.
Last year, President Obama ended the Federal Family Education Loan Program, a program that backed private student loans. What does this mean for going forward for borrowers?
If I could note that there's some confusion. It's very common between private lenders and private loans. That program provided fat taxpayer subsidies to private lenders to make federal student loans on the government's terms. We saved tens of billions of dollars by focusing on a more affordable way to make those same loans directly from the government, and that money was invested in Pell Grants and other higher education funds. And the securitization that Malcolm was discussing before applies both to loans made through that now defunct program, which includes a lot of outstanding debt for individual students, as well as private student loans, where there was a dramatic contraction in the market when the securitization market collapsed with the credit crunch. Those loans are starting to come back, and they are much riskier.
Go ahead, Malcolm.
That's certainly true, but one thing this doesn't do, that the ending the FFELP program was the sort of legislative cleverness we're probably not going to see on this issue again for a long time. But what it doesn't do is put downward pressure on tuition prices. Opening up the federal treasury to lenders instead of just backing private lenders may save the federal government a bunch of money, but it's not going to save students a bunch of money.
My guests are Malcolm Harris, whose article Bad Education is in the current issue of N+1, and Lauren Asher, founder of the Project on Student Debt and president of the Institute for College Access and Success. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Lauren, your organization recently sent a letter to Congress pushing for the reinstatement of student loan discharge through bankruptcy. Wasn't that an option as recently as 2005?
It was for private student loans, which, as I mentioned, are not a form of financial aid. They're entirely different from federal student loans and really are the riskiest way to pay for college and leave students at the complete mercy of their lenders if they do hit hard times. This was a change made to bankruptcy law as part of a big overhaul of bankruptcy law in 2005, which made it harder to qualify for bankruptcy. So even if you meet the stringent criteria for extreme financial distress that can allow you to declare bankruptcy, your federal student loans nor your private student loans since 2005 can be discharged. You have to go through a whole additional legal process where the odds of getting discharged are extremely low and quite arbitrary.
Is there anyone who benefits from a student loan defaulting, Malcolm?
Not
because in the end, doesn't everyone have to pay?
Well, the people who don't lose, I guess you could say, or don't lose nearly as badly, are the sort of private lenders we were talking about, because these loans have been backed by the federal government for the most part under the FFELP program. And this is stopped, but there's still roughly $800 billion in outstanding student loans under this program.
They also get a lot of money from late fees and penalties, I imagine.
Exactly. And also, once a student defaults and the government pays back the private lender, private lender still is still licensed by the federal government to keep hounding them for as much more money as they can get back.
Lauren, when you're getting so little return on your investment, doesn't that mean that for many students their degree ends up becoming less valuable?
Well, right now we are still having a lot of trouble in our job market, as I'm sure everyone who's listening knows. But college graduates are still much more likely to get a job and get a higher paying job, both out of college and over their lifetime, than those with only a college high school diploma. Back to Malcolm's point, there has been, unfortunately, some perverse incentive in the FFEL loan program, which, while now it's over, there are still those outstanding loans that those lenders are trying to collect on. He's absolutely right. The incentives to help borrowers get manageable repayment plans and walk them through their steps and options was not as high as the incentive to, in some cases, let them default because the fees the lender could collect were even higher. What I didn't mention about the consequences of default for the borrower is that the amount that you owe also goes up dramatically. All your interest is capitalized. You can be charged tremendously high collection fees, even with federal student loans. So we do see also with private student loans, because of this really unfair special treatment of the lender compared to other similar types of lenders, I mean, even gambling debts are dischargeable in bankruptcy. With private student loans, even those who default, the lender can go after them in bankruptcy. And also the lenders can go bankrupt if something goes wrong. And that did happen with the providers of private student loans, these risky private products, during the credit crunch. Some of them went bankrupt. They walked away and could start new businesses. The borrowers are left holding the bag.
Well, Lauren, you keep on talking about the value of a college education, but there was a time when an alternative was well-paying blue-collar jobs. Those no longer are an alternative, are they?
Unfortunately, part of the growing wage or premium between those with college degrees and those without is the decline in the value of a high school diploma in the marketplace. There's no getting around that. It's made the need for some kind of college credential, whether a associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, or a certificate, even greater. And we know that demand for higher education always goes up when the economy is down, which unfortunately is the same time that state resources for higher education also go down. It's why it was so important that the Pell Grant was increased as part of the stimulus bill and that increase was made permanent. Unfortunately, there are real threats to that increase in Congress right now, and we in student and other consumer groups are working hard to try and ensure that that maximum grant of $5,550 is still available to people who are seeking to get that wage premium. If it's helpful, college graduates with an associate's degree earn at least 30% more than those who only finished high school, and they're half as likely to experience unemployment. Full-time workers with a bachelor's degree earn about 75% more than high school graduates.
But it depends on what your degree is in. You're much more likely to earn a lot of money if you have a degree in business or in law or in medicine than if you have studied pre-Elizabethan lit or become a philosophy major. Excuse me?
I'm talking about just undergraduate degrees, so just associates and bachelor's degrees, people who don't have more degrees than that. Absolutely, if you're an engineer, your odds of getting a job and a well-paying job right out of college are probably higher. Over time, though, you do see that wage premium apply more evenly across different types of degrees. However, it is important to note that for-profit colleges, on average, are producing far more people who can't get the value of their degree. Default rates are one indicator of how hard it is for people to pay their loans back, and it's just the tip of the iceberg because it's the extreme case of those who couldn't pay them back in, as Malcolm pointed out, a very short period of time. People who graduate with an associate's degree from a for-profit college are much more likely to default than people who drop out from other types of colleges.
Well, it also has to do with the composition of this, the wage premium, is that if we look at the kind of postgraduate jobs where wages are increasing or if at least kept up with inflation even. We're looking at a small sector. The financial industry, unsurprisingly given the conversation, has anchored the wage growth for college graduates. If you look at other kinds of industries, you've seen wages stagnate or drop even for college graduates over the last decade.
Arthur in New Jersey writes, the interest rate on student loans is out of line with the market. My son just graduated from law school, and his loan interest rate is about 8%.
That sounds like a grad plus loan. At least I hope it is. I'm not a private student loan. Those are loans available to graduate students above and beyond other types of federal aid up to the full cost of attendance. Graduate degrees generally have a much higher premium than undergraduate degrees, and they are still eligible for income-based repayment, unemployment deferments, and other options that can help you manage that debt. There's no question that you could, in theory, find a loan at a lower interest rate somewhere, depending on what your credit rating was and what kind of cosigner you had, but it would not come with those important consumer protections.
Well, if people take out loans that there is a good chance they can't pay, how much responsibility lies with them?
Well, in the, like Lauren was saying, they've been sold this sort of bill of goods of the wage premium. They've been sold that you have to go to college. You know,
I see these ads on television saying a college degree means $1 million more earning over a lifetime.
Right, and the government has decided that since they don't want to deal with labor problems or class problems, that they're going to solve all of the nation's social ills through education. And that if we could only send every student to college, then we wouldn't have a problem of poverty and inequality. But what we'd really have is a lot of really credentialed food service workers.
Lauren, Tracy on Facebook asks, what about the public service loan forgiveness program? Will it actually remain in place long enough for people to qualify?
That's a great question, and every indication is yes. Public service loan forgiveness was created at the same time as income-based repayment in 2007. Income-based repayment became available in 2009. If you're making income-based repayment payments, or IBR payments, on a direct student loan, which is this one type of federal student loan, and if you have FFEL loans, you can consolidate into the direct loan program. You can even reconsolidate into the direct loan program. And you're working. So if you're making the right kind of payment on the right kind of loan and in the right kind of job, you can qualify for forgiveness on your debt after just 10 years of affordable payments. That means any job, full-time or equivalent, for a nonprofit or public employer, and a payment that's either an IBR payment or a 10-year payment. If you can make 10-year payments, you're doing all right. You won't need forgiveness. They have to be at the same time. And they don't have to be concurrent. They don't have to be consecutive. So if it takes you longer and you move in and out of those sectors, you still have that option.
What about the other students who've already defaulted? What are their options?
Well, let me just back up for a second. With income-based repayment, you can get forgiveness after 25 years, regardless of what kind of jobs you have. And if your income is very low, below 150% of the poverty line for your family size, your required payment is actually zero, but you're not in delinquency or default. Those payments count towards forgiveness in either public service loan forgiveness or after the 25-year IBR period. It's very important for people to know. If you do default on a federal student loan, there are ways to rehabilitate your loan or to consolidate out of default, and the best resource for that information is studentloanborrowerassistance.org, run by the National Consumer Law Center, which has the nation's expert on consumer rights with student loans. But if you're in default, it can take a long time to rehabilitate your credit rating. If you have a private loan, your options are far fewer. You've got to read the fine print in your promissory note, talk to your lender, and frankly, cross your fingers.
Absolutely.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Lauren Asher is founder of the Project on Student Debt and president of the Institute for College Access and Success. Malcolm Harris, his article, Bad Education, is in the current issue of N Plus One magazine. And we have a link to that on our show page at WNYC.org. Also a link to Project on Student Debt and other resources for student borrowers. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.